Aeneid, which is 585. So the one we actually really want to pay attention to is 586. But you should actually read 585, 586, 587, or the, and this is Plotinus on intellectual beauty. It's one of his more famous passages. This one is extremely
is this PDF 1, pages 1 to 14?
Yeah, we're on PDF, the PDF page is 8.
Okay.
8, so I'm going to be starting on sort of the end of 8, 9, and go to 9, starting with the McKenna translation. I included both classic translations, and we'll discuss a little bit of what that's about. Stephen McKenna was a guy who, Irishman, who spent decades translating Plotinus, the turn of the century from about 1900 through the 30s, I guess. Starved to death in the process, almost died, almost froze to death in Ireland there. Was through a subscription, and towards the end of his life, he was very ill from all the deprivation that he had in his life in order to do this. But he was profoundly, he had that profound orientation for him. You know, Plotinus was not just, I think he represented a profound spiritual force, which for McKenna was something that was for him almost a religion. Similar in some ways, though, to Thomas Taylor. But of course, Thomas Taylor lived the century before, almost a good 75, 80 years before, and was in London. McKenna's translation was highly regarded until another Irishman, Armstrong, came along, who was didn't suffer as much, but he spent also almost 30 years retranslating Plotinus. The differences in terms of the translations have to do with shifting intellectual styles in England, in English literature and philosophy, and understanding of philosophy. So McKenna comes at the time when a form of Hegelian idealism was dominant in the academy. That's circa about 1900. That was the thing that Bertrand Russell railed against. I mean, he was all against it when he was a young man. But McKenna represented the idea. It was definitely oriented towards this idealist trend in philosophy. And so his language shows that. And whereas Armstrong came in the more sober area of mid-century, meaning mid-last century, about circa 1950s, 60s. And so the language has changed a little, mainly to probably make Plotinus more encompassing. You'll see where some of the language is confusingly different. So with that, if you're on page 8, towards things, I'm going to start with true wisdom, then found to be identical with the intellectual principle.
Is now, wait a minute, is that what the translation is made at 5.86?
I'm sorry, David. What was that again?
My pages aren't numbered, I don't, I guess, but it's Stephen McKenna translation, Aeneid 5.86.
Yeah, 5.85 we're starting. So just back up a page or so. And we're Stephen McKenna translation, Aeneid 5.8.5.
Is it only a part back?
Three paragraphs down. True wisdom, then, and this is not, this is a translator aside, found to be identical with the intellectual principle. Note, intellectual principle is not what is intellectual. In fact, it's almost the opposite of what we think is intellectual in terms of our normal use of intellect. Intellectual here represents the principle of light, of pure consciousness. And it's a direct translation for nous, N-O-U-S, in the Greek, nous. And it represents, it was also considered in its lower aspect to be reason, in its higher aspect to have an ecstatic thing. But true wisdom, then, is found to be identical with the intellectual principle, is real being. And this is, and real being is wisdom. Now, Armstrong calls real being substance in his thing. So what is real being? Notice that it's capitalized. So real being represents not just what we would see in the world, but the world as it is constituted by divine reality. So wisdom is capitalized. You could say that God is existence, or God is being. God is substance. And so to the degree that we exist, it's because we exist in God, because God is the only real being, and we exist as a color, a modulation, not in the existence itself, but in how that existence shows itself to itself. It's pretty simple in a way, but just assume that everything that actually exists is God, and we presume that we exist, but we actually don't exist because our existence is as a gift, a free gift of the divine, which, you know, normally is called creation. And so we're existing in this sort of borrowed being, or our substance. All right, well, I don't want to get too much into Plotinus, but this is relevant to our interpretation of all these images. Real being is, in virtue of its origin in wisdom, it follows that all forms of existence not possessing wisdom are indeed beings in right of the wisdom which went in their forming, but as not in themselves possessing it, are not real beings. It's sort of, another way of saying this is consciousness trumps existence per se, but consciousness trumps appearances, or what appears to be. So appearances may have their appearances there, but they aren't necessarily beings in themselves, real beings. We cannot therefore think that divine beings of that sphere or other supremely blessed there need look to our apparatus of science, and this is science just be anything that has to do with reason or understanding. All the realms of the very beings themselves, all is noble image. Such images as we may conceive to lie within the soul of the wise, that there is not as inscription, but as authentic existence. The ancients had this in mind when they declared ideas, forms, to be beings, essentials. Okay, so that's like a McKinnis translation, kicking down a little bit, starting with Armstrong's translation of the same portion. Let's see, where does it go?
No, I have to say, I find that rather confusing. The thing is, what's he talking about? He's talking about beings that don't have wisdom and beings that do have wisdom.
Now, don't go down that road. You're thinking about it. Just listen to what Armstrong says, and try to get out of that bifurcating mind here. It's not helping you. Let me look here. Going from Armstrong down about center of the page, a little bit beyond the center of the page, it goes, true wisdom then is substance, and the true substance is wisdom. And the worth of substance comes from wisdom. It is because of this that it comes from wisdom that it is true substance. Basically, that's consciousness trumps appearances, okay? Therefore, all the substances which do not possess wisdom, because they have become substance on account of some wisdom, but do not possess wisdom in themselves, are not true substances. One must not then suppose that the gods, or the exceedingly blessed spectators, in the higher world contemplate propositions. And that's where he had science, he's bringing it down more to this logical form. But all the forms we speak of about are beautiful images in the world of the kind which someone imagined to exist in the soul of the wise man. Images not painted but real. This is why the ancients said that the ideas were realities and substances. And then there's this note. What I did is I threw in the notes that Armstrong included. That one I don't particularly want to deal with. Now we're going to the real substance of what why I pulled this passage. I just wanted a little context here, which is let's see. This is McKenna translation, and this is the part. This has to do with tarot cards.
Which image?
The Aeneid 5:8-6.
Okay.
So we're reading the whole thing. It's just a couple of paragraphs. It's pretty short. It's about a page in the book. Similarly, it seems to me the wise of Egypt, whether in precise knowledge or by native intuition, indicated the truth where, in their efforts towards philosophical statement, they left aside the writing forms that take in the detail of words and sentences those characters that represent sound and convey the propositions of reasoning, and that would include, by the way, mathematics, drew pictures instead, engraving in the temple inscriptions a separate image of every separate item. Thus, they exhibited the absence of discursiveness in the intellectual realm. For each manifestation of knowledge and wisdom is a distinct image, an object in itself, an immediate unity, not an aggregate of discursive reasoning and detailed willing. Later, from this wisdom and unity, there appears, in another form of being, a copy, already less compact, which announces the original in terms of discourse, and that, by the way, this copy, this less compact, this is also known as a tarot reading, announces the original in terms of discourse and unravels the causes by which things are such that the wonder rises how a generated world can be so excellent. For one who knows must declare his wonder that this wisdom, while not itself containing the causes by which being exists and takes such excellence, yet imparts them to the entities produced according to its canons. This excellence, whose necessity is scarcely and not at all manifest to search, exists if we could but find it out, for all are searching and reasoning. What I say may be considered in one chief thing, and hence applied to all the particular entities. Then he goes on to the next Aeneid chapter, and that one is on the beauty of the natural world. And he also goes on beyond that. But he moves on, has his chief example. The world, our natural world, the world we live in, is itself a living symbol of divine wisdom. Okay, now this is Armstrong's translation of the same thing. And again, I'm going to skip the parenthesis, the stuff that's in italics, because those are notes that Armstrong wanted. The wise men of Egypt, I think, also understood this, either by scientific or innate knowledge. And when they wished to signify something wisely, did not use the forms of letters, which follow the order of words and propositions and imitate sounds and the enunciations of philosophical statements, but by drawing images and inscribing in their temples one particular image of each particular thing, they manifested the non-discursiveness of the intelligible world. Key phrase, the non-discursiveness of the intelligible world. That's why we read tarot cards. That is, that every image is a kind of knowledge and wisdom and is subject to statements all together in one and not discourse or deliberation. But only afterwards, others discovered, this would be tarot readers, started with it in its concentrated unity, a representation in something else, already enfolded in speaking it discursively and giving the reasons why things are like this. So that, because what has come into existence is so beautifully disposed, is anyone knows how to admire it, he expresses his admiration of how this wisdom, which does not itself possess the reasons why substance is as it is, gives them to the things that are made according to it. That then, which is beautiful in this way, which is what the difficulty or not all discovered by research to be necessary like this, if one were to find it out, exists before research and before reasoning. For instance, let us take one great example, which I am saying, which will fit all other cases. And then he goes on, as I said, to invoke the universe, the manifest universe and all of its beautiful possibilities, the world. Okay, so that was our inspiration. Thing. Actually, it was, I actually had that plan to be read last week, but took up the weight thing instead. But so does anyone have a sense of why I wanted to emphasize this passage?
Okay, taking the hieroglyphics analogy that...
Oh, no, forget the hieroglyphics. He's actually talking about, not the hieroglyphics. He's not talking about hieroglyphical language representation. He's talking about pictures on the temple wall of the gods. Or, in our particular case, it would be the images that are on these tarot cards.
Isn't he saying that the images that are on the temple walls have their own intrinsic meaning, their own intrinsic detailed meaning? And the thing is, it behooves us as the reader, as the tarot reader, to take that knowledge and put it into our own words during the discursive pattern.
Yeah, and that's... That's right. In other words, so you know the old you know saying, you know, a picture is worth 10,000 words.
Right.
Well, that's pretty much what tarot reading is. We look at a picture and immediately start generating 10,000 words. Though most of us usually are not quite that verbose, with some exceptions, I guess. But
so he's using a lot of words to say a simple process, I think.
Oh, actually, it's not a simple process because the key, and you have to have an appreciation for Plotinus' system. And you can look it up in any number of places. There are good articles that will give you a key to his Plotinus' system. But he presumes that you understand his system. But his system is, he's talking about this level of wisdom. He's talking about the sort of the God generating the world, and the way God generates the world is through wisdom and consciousness, and the other way that God generates the world is that it's reflected in the substance of things, which is also God, and we exist in this in-betweenness. Remember that one of the things I said specifically about this mysticism that we're talking about is we have the beginning of purification, which is when we don't, then we have this illuminative way, and then we have the way of unity. See, specifically talking about how we see everything as it is, as the presence of God in an illuminative way. This is where everywhere I turn, I see God's face. Everything I see is the divine. All of the energy that flows through me, all of my awareness is not mine, but is the presence of God. This is not unity. A lot of people think it is. This is the divine vision. This is the via illuminata. That's what these cards are representative of the trials and tribulations of our opening up in our soul to the work of the Spirit. And when we reach the end of the via illuminata, we are then on the precipice of the unity.
What? What was
somebody
that?
Must really like what I was saying.
Hallelujah.
No gospel there. I don't know that. I actually was reading. I asked somebody about a tarot thing on Facebook the other day, and I was trying to read a response to me, and I couldn't get in because the Facebook page was hung up. You know, so I couldn't fully read her response. And while I was waiting to finish reading her response, which had to do with the Five of Wands and the Hanged Man and what they would mean together as paired together. I heard this thing on the radio about the nature of dreaming.
Right.
And how dreams work. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I finally finished reading what she had to say about the Five of Wands and the Hanged Man. And then I immediately said, well, but you know, what I just heard on the radio is relevant to the same kind of change that she was talking about would take over, because you could see the Hanged Man as being like the dream where there's this change in point of view taking place, which is what they were saying about dreams. So I said, well, that's a form of tarot reading by synchronicity. So I think we just had a little more synchronicity hit us here. Okay. That's as much religion as I'm going to hit you with tonight. So let us launch into the Hermit. Number 20. It's Chesed Tepereth, so it's the Hermon is between Chesed and Tepereth. So, the other title for it is the Keeper of the Secret Tradition. And it is following the Last Judgment, in which we had the angel and the rainbow and the ascending person. And now we have this turnaround of the Hermon, looking at the what was the name of that three-pointed staff? Somebody mentioned that last week about what they called it, the bishop's staff or something like that.
I think it was the Orthodox cross, if I remember right.
No, that was the papal,
papal
staff.
The papal staff. Mm-hmm. I think something like that is what somebody said. There to remind us, I'm perfectly happy to hear it again. But let's talk about the Hermit and what we see with the Hermit here.
Looking
at the book, right. Now, notice that the thing that's interesting based on, in terms of progression of images, we have the angel, the person arising who's clothed with a crown, a rainbow thing. Here now, we have someone clothed, no crown, carrying a light, the papal staff. A much intenser aura, in other words, the halo around them is intense, and they seem to be, you know, floating around in the Milky Way.
We're on the Hermit.
That's plate 20.
Okay.
The name for here is the Keeper of the Secret Tradition. So you
get the feeling that the Hermit is star stuff. Stardust, so to speak.
Question. Why the Hermit here after the Last Judgment?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily have an answer for that, but it's definitely worthy of some consideration, at least.
Say that again, Paul. Why the Hermit?
Yeah, why the Hermit after the Last Judgment?
Well, the Last Judgment is divisible. So to speak, the divisible hand of God, and the Hermit is the invisible hand of God.
That's taking
a big jump, but.
Let's look at the motion. What would you say the motion is in the Last Judgment of the card? You're looking at the card moving up. Yeah, that's what I would say too. I mean, it's possible that you could say that that angel is hovering, but definitely the character below the rainbow is ascending. And here we have the Hermit
disappearing.
Standing still, mm-hmm. What I see. For me, the clearest image for me of this is are not the colored cards, but the black and white cards.
But nonetheless, they become more ephemeral, the colored cards, the true images.
But I'm not reading these cards necessarily. They may be ephemeral because over the years they faded out. We don't know.
The right away version, the right away slip version, remember they're standing on a mountaintop. In this particular version, she or he is in the celestial cosmos. He's totally alone.
is all by himself.
Right, and he's wearing a monk's robe, so he has the, and apparently there's a consistency of the rope.
With Franciscans.
Yeah, of Franciscans. It's pretty consistent, at least in two of the images.
But it's as if the eye is in front of them. In the first plate.
What do you mean? You're talking about the
halo.
The halo is circular, and the lamp is not in the center, nor is the head in the center.
No, right. But Paul, you're not hearing what Patricia says. He's saying that the halo is in front of him. He's behind that halo.
It's as if he's entering a funnel.
Yes.
Oh, I see what you're saying, Cynthia. For instance, in the colored... Are you talking about the colored plate? Or the black and white?
Yeah, plate 20. What's labeled as plate 20.
Okay.
We don't know what actually weight used. We have no way of knowing, and there are three or four images per card. So it is interesting from that point of view. And they're not crayon cards.
Well, look at the yod, which is the letter for this.
Mm-hmm.
And you have hand, clenched fist, power, strength, and assistance as being a vehicle of tradition and teaching. But, So the teaching here, if the teaching of the Last Judgment has to do with ascension or immortality or something, here it seems to be that the teaching has to do with some form of transcendence. However, the transcendence in some ways is within the darkness. In other words, it's not,
I feel with the Last Judgment is that the crown figure is having an experience. However, in the Hermit, he is offering an experience.
Well, when I'm looking at the Last Judgment, I'm going to put equal weight on both figures, rather, because they're both about the same size.
Okay.
Rather than assuming identifying with one, I'm going to assume both, and so in that way it would be sort of like here's the embodied self or the ascending self, and here is the angelic self. You know, could be the same thing.
The other thing I do have to offer it's at least artistically the angel, the body of the angel, not the butterfly wings in the Last Judgment, but her body. To me, correct me if I'm wrong, Johanna, because I don't have technical terms for this. It's almost as if there's like a fur-like quality.
Well, I call that feathers.
And likewise with the halo of the Hermit.
I saw the body of the angel is feathered.
Okay, feathered then. That's fine too.
Yeah, but the okay. Well, right now let's just stick with the motion. So my position of the motion of the Hermit is, you know, being like in space. And being open to this thing. What's also this attribute of light, which I think when we take up the next card, which is death. And again, now with death, with calm, we go from symbolic meaning of hand and clenched fist. Which is, you know, holding light in the clenched fist. And now what we have with death is we have the palm of the hands. So a way in the hands. A hollow cave in a vault. and go back to looking at plate 21 for death.
And now, the pentacle or pentacle seems to have almost a dreidel-like image at the very tip of it in the plate.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see it too.
Yeah,
that's a five-pointed star, and on the Hermit, it's an eight-pointed star.
Mm-hmm. Similar somewhat to the eight stars of the star played in the Rider-Waite Smith.
I think we need a magnifying glass when we look at these pictures sometimes.
Let's identify the elements. Let's identify the elements in the death card. We have a naked person laying on the bottom of the card, laying prostrate, head down.
That is so weird.
Why? It's very similar to the Ten of Swords in that regard.
Yeah, it is, but you don't think of people being buried that way.
But
in the Jewish religion, they are.
Face down?
I don't know.
No, they're not buried face down. Actually, being buried face down was a curse.
Really?
Yeah. And I mean, it's not a universal curse. It's just, but it is. You know, it was a sign of. That you're not going to the underworld in a proper way.
Oh, I see. Oh, I didn't. What culture did that?
I'm not sure.
Oh, now I gotta Google that one. Being buried face down.
One of those utterly useless pieces of knowledge that I don't really have a strong context.
But it's so definitely in context to this.
Look at some of the other qualities, because I want to compare these.
Okay.
This image with some of the previous cards. There's a repetition of images here.
You know what?
So we also have the star, which may be on a pillar.
Yeah, what is that?
The pillar may be in a cave. Well, this might be stalagmites coming down there. Obviously, I'm going by the black and white image here.
You know, I know this sounds crazy, but honey, you'll know what I'm saying. To me, this image is almost a UFO kind of.
Yeah, definitely.
Out here.
Right.
Many of these images do have that that repeated motif of the beam of light and the near death kind of quality.
Mm-hmm. And excellent. And I think that some of these images, we really have to go back and look at some of the previous images that we've had.
Yeah, I do too. I think those three arcs hark back to the papal staff.
The papal staff
three arcs right above the body.
Three steps.
I see those as steps, but yeah.
Yeah, but I think they could be representative of that staff as well.
The rainbow.
In the third image of
the rainbow too.
Oh, it's much more steppy.
It's four steps. Yeah. Or it looks like it may be four steps.
Yeah, but when you get to the Hierophant, he has three steps. So, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah, the Hierophant, I don't see three steps of the Hierophant.
Oh, yeah,
that's
they are.
Four. Well,
the major ones are the carpeted ones are three.
Yes, they are.
Oh, wait a minute.
And that's like the carpeted part.
When you said Hierophant, I immediately was looking at the Hermit, so. That's my error.
And it is interesting that on the Grassy, which is arranged astrologically, the Hierophant and the Emperor are closest to Keter.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of personal experiential or personal interpretation on the part of the masters of Tarot, so to speak, in the Golden Dawn for how they
This is not Golden Dawn, okay?
Right.
Wade had another name for his group.
The Rosy Cross?
It was called something, but I don't think it was specifically called the Rosy Cross, no. But he had another name for his group. If you want to allude to that, that's the group that we should be talking about, not the Golden Dawn.
Okay.
Except by a longer thing. Golden Dawn, right?
How do you say that the Golden Dawn was like a first baby step, and then his group would be the more...
I think that he did his group to be much more explicitly mystical,
right?
Much more explicitly sacramental, and right. Much more explicitly Catholic.
We're looking at that star again.
Not just look at the star. Look at the whole picture.
Look at the star there, and look at the next two pages. The figure actually begins to fade away, and the star becomes dominant.
Wait a minute. Please, let's not read these images as progressive. Rather, please, let's look at the images as variants of one image, rather than seeing that there's some value to the inner being of the body that's inside the thing disappearing.
Do we have any historical evidence for which image came first, second, third, fourth, whatever?
I doubt it. I'm not the person to ask.
Tell me why you can't read it that way, Paul.
There's a reason. The reason for it is, as far as we know, they're variants on the same image rather than progressions of an image. In other words, it was never meant. It was, you're going to have one statue in one place. It means that you're going to have one of these cards. Right? When we have three variants of the cards, we're going to read each card as a variant of one image rather than as some kind of progressive thing. I mean, you can read it there. You can read it the other way that you're doing. I just don't want to do that in this initial analysis of the thing. In other words, if we wanted to do the progressive thing, that's something we can do once we've gone through all the images and have a sense of what symbols mean. And that's what I'm trying to get us to at least name. I want us to name what these symbols are, even if we don't know what they mean yet. So we have someone lying, a dude lying prostrate. We have some steps. We have a cave, apparently a cave. I'm not saying it is, but it seems that way to me. We have a star. We have a pillar. We have a person inside the star who is also nude, and whose nude posture, is similar to the clothed posture in the Last Judgment. So you could say here, and so again, we have, what's the symbolism of the clove versus the nude? It's an extremely important symbolism, this whole set of cards. We still haven't gotten a handle on what the meaning might be. We have a sense of light. We have this profound rainbow, and we're going to be stumbling into that profound rainbow in just a couple more images here. The question here is, what could this mean? I'm not, there's a lot. So in some ways you could see this, we're going from this completely open celestial realm of the stars to the underworld. So we have completely open outer space, Milky Way, bingo, now we're stuck in a cave. Even though there's a star in the cave, and there's a suspense of the cave, it looks like it may be an underworld.
I would say that's true in Plate 21. However, as we said last time, what we have in the progression, and I do agree with David, it would appear to be a progression of less materiality and going towards spirituality in the progression of this particular image with this rendering, these three renderings. And there is a forest. It's not so much a cave, although there seems to be above the dead body the suggestion of a cave, but the star is already ascending towards the heavens.
Well, I disagree. I disagree. The star is very much in the cave. It's not going towards the heavens. And I think that if we don't have that understanding of the underworld, the very face that we have someone face down in the dirt should give us a really solid clue that we're in the underworld.
Well, I agree with you on the poll on take 21. But the next
right.
page over,
right.
it's in a body is lying on the grass in a glade, and there's about 10 or 15 different yew trees there.
Okay, you're seeing those as trees rather than part of the cave. Yeah, I also interpreted that.
They're not trees. They got trunks, they got the branches.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if those are yew trees.
I could see them as possibly trees, and I could also, so I'm not going to disagree with that particularly.
Cypress trees, do you like? Those tall, narrow cypress trees.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I see them as, too. They would be the cypress trees. But the cypress trees, then, are something that's between the worlds, you know?
Yeah.
And so in the last, for instance, in the last picture of the star, if it wasn't a cave, now apparently the cave at the very top above the star, as you can see, you could say that would be some sky up there. Even though we're maybe in the underworld, here this is a star. There's some sky.
Actually, I feel it's a human. The image is very much the figure of death moving upward, less in the star, more above.
Well, and my take on death in this particular case is the person in death is the separation of the soul, the body, the...
It's not like a death of the body, but a rebirth of the spirit.
Yeah, well, it's a separation. Your body's dead. Mm-hmm. And your soul becomes the star.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, besides Crowley, it's actually an image right out of the ancient world where the souls are stars.
Have you read the Egypt series by John Crowley, no relation to Alistair?
Well, but again, I'm just simply saying that it's in the ancient tradition.
Yes, it is.
We don't need to cite a lot of instances of it.
No, that was the one I was thinking. Just that one.
But okay. So all right. So we've gone. We have an interesting transition of Last Judgment. We have.
I looked up the cypress tree on the internet. It says the cypress tree in southern European climates receives the symbolism of bodily death and spiritual immortality.
Oh, okay.
So there we go. So you're right, and the cypress tree does exactly represent what this card is talking about. Then this death is proof of immortality. That's what the image of the card thing. The body may die, but the soul lives on. I'm kind of glad that you looked that up because that actually gives us a really good segue into our next image, which is 22, the Hierophant. And all of a sudden, you know, here we are.
Completely different.
We got them steps again, you know.
Enclosed.
They got the steps in play, but now all of a sudden we're in, and instead of a cave.
Well, I want to go back to that death card again.
All right.
The last image of the death card, you said it looked like it was in a cave. I agree to you there. Above the star, those look like cypress trees. And then the overarching sky.
I agree. In the third image, I agree that looks like a sky up there.
Okay, yeah. Now the star looks like it's in a cave. And the last step has a curve on it. It looks like there's something deeper down there. In fact, there's a shaft that goes down to that body. The body is way, way down there.
Yeah, the three images are totally different in context.
Mm-hmm.
Totally. It's amazing.
Well, I don't feel totally,
they're definitely. I mean.
Okay, I mean, from my point of view, the black and white image is pretty obviously a cave.
Mm-hmm.
The third image, it's pretty obviously not so much a cave because those do look like cypress trees.
Right.
And then the third image, it could be a cave or the opening of a cave.
And steps.
Opening of the sky, and we have a lot of darkness between.
I think that body looks like it's in a vault. A burial vault.
A burial vault in the sense of Christ. And there is an image inside the star in the third one. It's very faint, but it's definitely there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably nude. We can't really quite tell. But the let's continue. We can talk about I want to talk about a lot more of the, I want to do some more comparison in a minute, but in order to do that, we still got to get through the Hierophant, the Hanged Man, and the Sun. So let's move on to the Hierophant now, and you know we can come back and look at these things. But as I said, David, saying that Cyprus thing brings the whole shows of the. You know, from my point of view, this seems really disjointed, you know, to suddenly have this Hierophant here. But
I agree.
Looking at it again, it actually carries on the same symbolism from several of the other cards. We've got the three steps, as in the other cards. This place, this alcove or whatever it is very much like a cave. There is in the crown that he's not in the and also the stained glass window, you have the cross, but you could also see that as symbolic of that light descending from the cave or from the from this. Again, he's wearing rather than being nude, which is the case of in the death guard. And in the simple monk's robe of the hermit, now we have the great sacerdotal robes of a bishop. No staff.
Mm-hmm.
And he's sitting, right? One of the big things in this deck of images is sitting versus standing. A lot of the images are standing. They're not doing too much more. They're sitting, they're standing, or they're lying down.
I don't think there's any sitting image that isn't rogue.
Well, the emperor and the empress are not necessarily. They're clothed, but I wouldn't say they're rogue.
They're clothed.
They're not wearing sacerdotal. This guy is.
And no hands.
Red, crimson red, and there's a lot of that's a very obvious. It's one of the more distinctively colored cards here, much more robustly colored. And then if we look at the third image, here the hands are
revealed.
Are revealed. And I think that may have and also that's an awfully
feminine
face.
Yes.
Also the steps, the first step of the third image, you have a cross laid down, and you have much more the issue of the cave coming in there.
Well, I'm looking at the book, and color-wise, in the third image, it's reminiscent of the cypress trees.
Yeah.
In the third image, yes. Oh, I see. In the feminized version with the hands.
Right, in the third one, right.
So, moving back to...
Also, there's an emphasis more in the breast, if you look at the part of the chest.
That is very interesting.
It's an older person.
But now the differences in interpretation...
between the images.
Right. Definitely right. Male and then female. This has hardly any reference to the previous black and white and colored image. You know what I'm saying?
What the difference is that instead of being obviously in a church in which it's dead, so it might be in a sort of cave, and this thing, if it's in a church, and it could be, it's at night, and the light is very different. So
I have
but
to
it
say
also,
I got a sinister feeling from all three images. It's just totally different, the feel of it. It's almost scary.
Well, okay, let's...
I don't know why they would have rendered it that
way.
Let's
deal with... What is the Hierophant? Okay, let's deal with
this. Let's read.
Go to the text on 131. Let's play with this for a bit. Somebody want to read that little cross, that little poem by A.U. Waite?
His name is Spring. His name is Eos, born of dews and light. His are the thousand names in one contained, before the threshold of the mystery, before the temple of the rose and cross, before the secret sacred in those shrines. And white refulgent as he wont arrayed, he stands in beauty and with open hands. He welcomes in the light of Christus, cries eternal truth. You know, it's such a fitting for me.
The Hebrew letter is ox or goad.
Lama, yeah.
To learn by rote, to study, practice, train, teach, instruct, define, deduce.
Yeah.
So, in some ways here, we have a opening up of, taking these sacred mysteries and we're, what's the word I want to look for? Not taming them. We're domesticating them in a way. Well, obviously, we're making them into a sacrament, but it's a sacrament in which human control is the issue.
And you know what's weird too in the second image of the Hierophant? The curtains or the pillar almost look like lion's feet at the bottom, side by side to him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I believe it's the face of a female lion.
It looks more female, yes, than male.
The lion.
Right.
You're talking about on the possible armrest. Of the
right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, because it doesn't have a mane. an exuberant mane at the male lion's mouth.
You're saying it's a cat of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and actually, if you look at the black and white one, you can see that those knobs are there too. That the lions are not clear. And obviously, in the third one, there is no clear. Well, the thing about the third one is that the Hierophant himself is the source of illumination, which is above the throne, but the Hierophant, and there may be a backlight, but even so, the backlight is not washing out what's in front. So
but it's stripped of a lot of the doodads of his station, his her station.
Yeah, the robe is
open,
and under is a simpler robe, which is reminiscent of the emperor and the empress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, why nude, why clothed? It's a big thing. We're going to have to figure that one out at some point.
This figure is like half clothed, half...
Oh, let's get on to the hangman. I love this.
White standing, white sitting. Big issue.
Right.
What do you think
so far? I'm not holding you to your final thoughts, but your thoughts on standing, sitting, robes, and robes. What would you have to say about it so far?
In the Bible, there's a continual theme of from the old man to the new man. And Waite spoke about coming out of an old condition, being unclothed, and entering into a new condition. So the clothes would signify the old way, the old man, perhaps spiritually separated, then going through a spiritual process which would render you unclothed, so you would enter a new life.
So you see the nudity as representing transformation, a new life.
Transformation.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Clothing
yes.
represents maybe a completion, right? A completion
yes.
of an understanding of something. So instead of like when you have clothes on, it means you're in a settled position, which of course also represents sitting. If you're sitting, it means that you're settled. You know what you know. You are what you are. You don't need to move. See?
You've taken your position, haven't you?
Where
you've taken your position.
Yeah. If you're standing, you're in transition. In this case, it represents a form of respect, possible respect or movement. Of course, in this case, we don't see anybody actually. And then, of course, we also have lying down. Recumbent. So we don't have a lot of recumbency here. We also have, then again, also the standing angels with various wings. But I think that this sitting thing is really important.
The death part, I see a resurrection of the spirit in mortality, and it's almost as though after that resurrection, a new man is born, and in this instance, it's the Hierophant, and he's seated, or she is seated, and is ready to take their position, to rule, to govern, to teach.
Oh, and you're
so transformation is taking place.
So you're talking about the naked image inside the star.
Yes. Yeah, the naked image inside the star is to me represents the etheric body of the physical body that's laying flat, dead. And then the etheric body has transcended. It's been resurrected or purged, has some kind of spiritual transformation, and then the Hierophant is almost like the leader, so as it's been reborn into the Hierophant being seated appears majestic, ready to rule. So it's a transformation of the spirit into another part, another
In the New Testament, Jesus Christ is never, this is the best of my knowledge, correct me, Paul and David, I don't have an immediate reference to him sitting.
He's sitting at the right hand of God.
Yes, but I'm talking about during his ministry.
No, yes.
During his ministry. And, of course, the higher authority would be the ministry.
You do have Jesus sitting during his ministry. You do have it. He's at table. He's eating with his people.
Yes.
There are a number of times.
And that is exactly what the Hierophant does. He receives that last supper.
Let's assume that the Hierophant represents Devachan, which is the place between. It's after you die, you go to a place where you sort of hang out before you reincarnate.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to do that because I want us to move on with the hangman and get to it. We don't want to run completely out of time. So I want to get to the hangman and the sun. And I think that if we look at that, the hermit, death, the hierophant, the hangman, and the sun, we're going to see a larger arc of the rebirth that you've been mentioning here. I mean, I don't disagree with you about the idea of the rebirth, but I don't think it takes place with the hierophant. You might say that the hierophant, you could maybe say, is even a midwife for this arc. But
I was thinking of the nativity and the crucifixion, both being naked.
Well, we have the crucifixion and the fool, which we dealt with last week.
Right.
And part of this progression, right? That we haven't talked too much today because we've been struggling with these things. So let's go to the hanged man here. And here the hangman is also called the crowned master, alternate time. Mem, which means water. We have here the divine self is submerged. They say sleeping. This is a very, but we also have now submerged under the ocean. We have sort of Noah's Ark. Sort of classic arc, or either that or it's Enriquez's hat floating around up on top there. And we've got the the recumbent character again with the crown.
I'm like a coral sofa.
Nude and slightly robed. You know, there's in the swastika, in the black and white plate, I think there is some cross robe around the midsection. And again, the king crowned in this sleeping thing. Again, going back to the rainbow, really saying, look for correspondences with the Last Judgment. So here we are, the hanged man and the Last Judgment, and they are symbolically very powerfully, the rainbow holds them together, but the rainbow also represents, in both images, a transition between an upper world and a lower world. In this case, the lower world is the world of the oceans. And we got fish in the second image. And we also have, floating on top there, this classic Noah's Ark image.
And this is one plate of four, which is unusual.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
That we have four plates.
Yeah, so apparently this was worked on a lot in terms of trying to get the images down. The things that are really consistent are the ark, the ocean, and the rainbow. Second major consistent image would be the recumbent figure, and third consistent image, though only obviously overwhelmingly the case in two, and I could argue for three. If you look at the first colored image and you see the robe, that robe in the first color image with the fishes is making a kind of watery swastika.
And also reminds me, anyway, of the world, the traditional world cloth around the figure.
Oh, standing upright, yeah.
Standing upright.
But, but in one case, this is recumbent straight out in a corpse pose, as they say in yoga. So
all four of those figures, too, they all have four crowns.
The crown is consistent. Let's see.
And the swastika definitely gives you the sense of constant perpetual motion.
Well, it's considered a sun wheel. You're saying
that the swastika is the sun wheel?
Yeah.
Or the rainbow?
No, the swastika is considered a sun wheel. If the German swastika, the Nazi swastika, goes opposing.
Well, actually, the classic swastika in Hindu and German, Hindu and Western European things is the flat swastika, the way these are. The Nazis put theirs up on edge, which was their slight innovation. And the swastika is whether they go one direction or the other. Represents either Widdershins or
right. Mm-hmm.
Clockwise or
counterclockwise. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Deal still or Widdershin.
Mm-hmm.
All I remember from my pagan upbringing.
There's also a change of weather if you look at the arc images. We end up with what might be the last image as more light surrounding the
ground. You guys are really stuck on trying to make these things progressive, aren't you?
Well, there is a similarity. The way Marcus Katz set this up, but the image is becoming more ephemeral. There's a progression in each set.
Well, I don't agree with your observation, but
I think the first and fourth image are similar in the fact that the arc looks like it's in a deluge.
I do agree, though. You did come up with a good observation about the arc, and that in some cases the arc looks like it's going either into a dawn or a midday or a storm.
A storm, it's a deluge.
Or a
days of rain at night.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so you aren't, I would agree with you that we've got the arc different climates up on top of there.
And of course, in Jewish lore, the Ark of the Covenant is the Holy of Holies. And Noah's Ark, and a rainbow is an ark. The zodiac is an ark.
Let's talk about what Noah's Ark is. It's a boat that human life and animal life were sustained during a deluge, right?
A lot of petri dishes.
Huh?
I would think of it as a lot of, like a scientific laboratory, a lot of petri dishes.
Well, I mean, yes. In some ways, this card is the most alchemical of all the cards.
Yeah.
Obviously, I mean, here for one thing, you have the Sleeping King, who represents the death and the rebirth of the soul. It's in a definite sense of hibernation, it's also, it's not fully nude. It's opened up, the crown is restored, where the crown has been away for a while, So, looking back, the last time the crown appeared, skipping the ornate headgear of the Hierophant, the last time there was a serious crown in here was the High Priestess had a serious was wearing some serious headgear, as with the Hierophant. And so I'm still looking for the last time we had a big crown. And it looks like I just skipped right over it. Okay.
The last judgment is a serious crown.
19.
Right. Last judgment.
The last judgment, yeah.
Right.
So, okay. So, we're in this position of the crowned master, the hanged man, and last judgment. So we're seeing that there's definitely a correspondence between those two.
Does anyone get a feeling of the Grail legend with the drowned man?
Oh, wait, you're talking about the Lady of the Austarian Lady of the Lake thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's not necessarily the Grail legend, is it?
No, it's an Arthurian legend.
That's all Arthurian.
Did they say the Arthurian? But the Holy Grail, the Ark, to me, is the Holy Grail.
Well, the Ark has been, the Ark and the Holy Grail were synonymous symbols in that whole thing. But to make the Ark all of a sudden into this, start looking for Grail legends, you can find, if you want to go for Grail things, where you're going to find the Grail is in the lamp, in the stars, particularly the star. You could argue for a lot of these images being sort of occulted grails.
Only because Wright was so into it. Otherwise, very frankly, I wouldn't be seeing it.
That's not the point. I mean, I don't know if it actually is serving us to understand the cards by looking. I mean, you could say that some of these things are, but what's more important is what do they mean? And I do want to move on from the hanged man, though we really haven't dealt with the symbolism yet and what it might be saying. Before we leave, let's deal with one more thing. What's the movement of the card? What's is there a movement going on there? Like the last time we had the rainbow, there was an obvious ascending. What's the movement here that's taking place?
I get a sense of protection.
Huh?
Protection.
Well, what does that mean?
I think the king is protected by the rainbow. The promise is the protection of our king.
Protection is not a movement.
No, I don't feel movement. I feel...
Well, there is some movement, but the movement is not up and down.
No.
Sideways.
No, right, horizontal.
it's a static. I mean, it's a stasis here.
Yeah.
It's submerged.
Yeah. Right. Okay. That's a good word. Really, stasis is a good word.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fully static, but it is a suspension.
Right. That's the closest analogy, the suspended one, to the hangman.
That's such an alchemical term, suspension.
Yeah. So that's what's happening. The king here is suspended
in time and space.
A special transfer. You could say it's a gestation of the soul. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's why I mentioned David Chan. You know.
Well, the iris. It's the flower that represents the rainbow and the goddess that represents the rainbow.
Uh-huh.
And is certainly in Waits' time and prior a female name.
Well, all right.
So we have the queen and the king alchemically in the bath.
Where are you going with that?
Yeah, where's this queen and king you're talking about?
I'm saying that the rainbow is the queen. And the drum.
You're stretching on that one, nothing.
I am, but I just feel like the first color
picture. If you look at the fishes going round,
mm-hmm.
Notice that if you look down there, you will see a skull.
Where?
No, that's an otter.
Huh?
That's an otter, I think.
Or an octopus.
I don't think it's an otter. I think it's a skull. A blue skull.
At the bottom. The center of the drowned master. At the very bottom.
Yeah, I'm seeing it.
Excuse me.
And you're seeing it as an otter, not as a skull.
Yeah, well, you know what? Next time, I will definitely bring a magnifying glass up here.
It's an octopus.
There are fishes around, but I'm not talking about the fishes. I'm talking about the thing that only has an eye and two eyes. A bald cap and
I see what you're saying, but
yeah.
It's not. I do not see the usual nostrils of a skull.
I agree also.
I'll have to enlarge it, or I have to take a magnifying glass to it.
It's an octopus, I think.
It's an octopus?
It could
be.
That's what it looks like.
Oh, yeah, right. I could see where there's tentacles. Yes. It may be an octopus.
You're going to say it might be an octopus.
Yes.
All right. What's the meaning of the fish? Right.
Christ?
Well, I don't know. The thing is, the letter mem has to deal with water.
We're running out of time, folks.
We're talking about fishes and water. That's a cup down there.
Let's move on to the next image.
The next image of the drum master.
No, we're going to the sun.
Okay, let's go to the sun.
Got to get through our five images.
Okay.
Well, all right. Then when was the last time we had this two images? You know, with the big, you know, the big one in the sky and the one below it.
Judgment. Yeah.
It was the last judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So we went from the last judgment where we have a rising king. Rising up through the rainbow to the feathered angel. Here we have, and of course, we also have the fool, in which who was nailed to the dark round globe. And here we have someone rogue, standing. Arms upstretched, the Christ image standing in a sun or a globe. Arms downstretched, both on one is blessings. That's the Christ image. The other one with the hands upstretched is reaching for transcendence, beseeching the divine.
That's our yogically sun salutation.
Yeah, okay, so you should say it's a sun salutation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that works, obviously. Okay, so,
It's the same figure as the fool with his hands overhead holding up Doth.
Right, right, mm-hmm. But here it's changed now. Now we're dealing with, and the fool we had, the issue was unconsciousness. There was definitely, at least the way I was reading, particularly that dark globe. And but here we're dealing with, pure consciousness, a real transcendence, and also profound integration, looking specifically at the Mogan David there.
Right.
And, again, we go from the watery issue to this profound thing. Notice there's, predominant yellow in the colored cards.
Mm-hmm.
Strong yellow.
Yeah, definitely.
I think the one interesting thing is that her foot is obviously bare in the one place where her foot is peeking, which is the first yellow thing. And again, it's a male-female polarity, which is real, real common everywhere.
Mm.
How about
you?
Thank you.
Yes. You know what I see here? When you do the test, the circle, and LVX, the symbol of repeated several times, but I always want to think, how come we didn't do the L and the X? Sign of Apophis and Typhon, sign of Osiris risen. This is the outstretched arms are a sign of Osiris risen in the Golden Dawn ritual.
But it also, it represents resurrection.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That's what it classically represents, mm-hmm. the resurrection of the rising of the sun, where you greet the new the morning sun, it definitely represents that, the solar flowering follows the awakening of the sleeping self in the previous great symbol, and the birth of Christ within, the entry into Tipperith as an epitaph for unification, but not yet union. So what we have here is the Christ Son, fully enlightened, fully illuminated, but not yet, unified. I don't know if, as I said, I don't think these symbols actually fully address the mysteries of unity, but that might be my prejudice.
So what's interesting is also if you look at the Tree of Life as rendered by Marcus, the Christos is on the, the right-hand pillar, Nun is on the right-hand pillar. All right.
By the way, our assignment, which might be considering our assignment for the end of the last class, which is not this, not next week, but the week after, will be to take all 23 images and in their paths, paying attention to where they are in paths, and come up with a plausible story of initiation. But what I would suggest you do is make notes to yourself of what you think are the most important symbolical transformations that, one, you see in the cards and that you can give meaning to. Basically, going from knowledge that is a pure gift. This is the sacramental knowledge of God. And then then knowledge as it opens into degrees of light to come to its full awakening, which is the world in this particular case, as it is. But following the path that's been set out here, so look up the meaning of the Sephiroth and how the Sephiroth, the two Sephiroth were each of these paths might influence the meaning of what it means for the Son Christ in its position and this pathway. It's going to be a little different than other ways of looking at it. And so if we all try to do that at the end, we won't come up with the same story that Marcus Katz came up with, but we'll come up with something which may be very interesting. And will leave us with a deep impression of working the paths and recognizing that the paths can be worked a lot of different ways than the traditional way or the limited ways that we have seen them in the past. So that's our that's the assignment for the last class. It's the one where we deal with about three images only, and then we deal with our conclusion. Our conclusion is coming up with a plausible story for the whole series. And I'm going to try to do it myself. I'm not saying that, but I would recommend everybody doing it. We'll come up with a better one that way. if we all do it, because we're all in this together here. So what's interesting here is we go from that static motion to suddenly, this sort of, popped up, out of the water motion. And there is this profound, super light, flowering, ascendant yippee. And then, of course, the next image that comes up, which is next week, is the devil, Lucifer. And if we look at the colored images of Lucifer, particularly the second colored one, we have these lamps, but we also have a nude versus a clothed Luciferian image.
Chained and unchained humans.
Yeah, and we have the humans. They're not chained. They're before an altar. The altar, in one case, has two steps. In another case, it has four steps. And or three steps, looking at the side rather than the other way. We have the candles, and we have the, and we also have hanging lamps, which are an interesting feature.
Well, those are
like
lilies. The three lilies of the resurrection are facing downward. And also, why do I see this? I see a vagina and spermatozoa.
Are you seeing those hanging lamps as spermatozoa?
Yeah.
Well,
and Lucifer encased in a vagina. I mean, that to me, it's supposed to be the smoke of the candles, but
that's like a Pisces for sure. I agree with you on that one.
Well, the other thing about the thing that I'm going back to is the king. And particularly the king in the water and the ocean, where we have that deep ocean thing.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have smoke, obviously, but it also does remind me of water. It's not obvious. You're right. It is obviously symbolically water. Moving on.
There's one thing I do need to point out. This are the feet, the two feet of Lucifer, as being let's see, 1, 2, 3, four, being in normal feet in the first image, pointed feet in the second.
Now you may have scooters on, right.
Cloven feet.
Right. You got it. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so they're trying to show something going here. Then we have the lovers. And again, you know, the classic one of the lovers and the devil.
Mm-hmm.
Well known, common. And here we have it again. And here we have the angel again. Again, rogue. Adam and Eve, you know. Eve's got her long hair again. We've got to go back a long ways before we get back to that long hair.
And there are very definitely grapes in the tree. The trees.
Well, yeah, or apples, yeah.
No, I
don't see grapes.
They're apples, they're grapes.
Where?
Grapes, I see them too.
You see grapes?
Grapes, I don't see them. Grapes.
Oh, yeah, they're grapes.
In the colored one?
No.
Yeah, not the colored one.
I'm not looking at the colored one.
Let me see.
Yeah,
right now. Yes, and then I can definitely see where
you
can
see,
it's a grape.
Actually, you can see an arbor not only of grapes, but also
yes.
You can see other fruit.
Other fruit, yeah. I see the grapes. Yes, I do.
And then we also... actually, I like the black and white one. I like the way they do that arboring of the two trees. And
mm-hmm.
Why are there two trees there?
Tree of life and the tree of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Then on to temperance. So we're moving into some really interesting questions about the meaning of this initiatory phase. The thing that I've been leaving out, and I apologize for it because in some ways it's key to understand how these things hang together, is we've been leaving out the sufferer and what they mean.
Right.
Right. Relevant to these images. And in one of my notes that I've already posted, there is a list of the sufferer and a list of what they mean. It's a very simple list. But you can go to any, you can easily just look up sufferer and you'll find plenty of lists on the internet. Take one of those lists and use them and then sort of see them as two polar things influencing the meaning of that particular card, looking at the card, what it might be symbolized. In some cases, you may even see that some of what the sephira are is showing up in the symbolism of the card. And that's one of the reasons why it's probably the biggest mistake of mine putting this discussion together is we haven't paid enough attention to the sephira. Anybody got anything they want to say now as we're getting ready to wrap up?
As for temperance?
Anything. Well, no, not particularly temperance.
Okay.
And because we're going to talk about temperance next week, and we've got a whole other five images to go for next week, and then we got three images in our what our conclusion will be.
Just to say that the hanged man as the crowned or drowned master is also a folio printed out, edited by Darcy Kuntz, written by Edward Way.
Yeah, well, actually, that's what we're going to be reading for next week.
Okay.
In that pamphlet you made available to us, we're going to read this. I think it's the second essay. And even though it was written much earlier, it doesn't correspond to the thing. From personally, I did get a hold of a copy of Waite's full book on the lamps of Western mysticism.
Oh, I have that also. I just got it.
I took a look at it, and I went through it, and from my point of view, it's not very helpful. There's a few things he says here and there that might be helpful if I wanted to sit around and spend my time extracting a few quotations from it. But he's not that fun to read, you know.
Okay. No, he's not.
So we're going to read this earlier thing, which deals more with classic Golden Dawn material. It was written earlier. But I think it'll be important. That'll be the quotes that we'll be dealing with first time next week.
Paul, this is Colleen. Can I make a comment here?
Yeah.
On plate 21, when we were looking at that series of three plates, in plate 1 and plate 3 of those, it looks like you're in the cave looking out. In the middle plate, it looks like you're outside looking at where the cave would be. And I'm wondering if that's not the perspective, you know, was he thinking of the light within and the light without? Or, you know, was that something he was working with? And also, in a since he was Catholic, in a Christian perspective, just the position of the figure in the grotto and in the grove of trees is... a lot of times the penitent will prostrate themselves in the aisle of the church.
That's a really good point. Particularly the idea of that is the classic position of a penitent, of total abjugation or subjugation to the thing. You know,
here we have it horizontal,
knocks
to the altar, and usually the penitent ritually in the church will be vertical with the head facing the altar.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there's good ritual examples of them being totally flat on their face.
Yes, flat on their face.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. I thought the way you said that it sounded like
flat on their face. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes the arms are out like a cross.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they are brought in towards the forehead.
And in this case, they're moved out above the head.
Above the head, yeah.
And then the third one, side by side.
And think about ritually what those three. Three different ways of positioning in this penitent position of being flat in your face. Have your arms straight out like in a cross versus down by your side versus in front of you above your head. Those are three very distinct postures and they could mean very distinct attitude.
Right, but nowhere does this figure at the bottom have his or her arms out as in a cross.
I know, but
they constantly refer to the folly of the cross, and I don't know what he means by that, but whatever.
The folly of the cross, which is the fool of the cross, you go back, you look at the fool image here, and you'll see what it is. It actually has to do with, it isn't Christ who's the fool. Christ is made a scapegoat by human beings. We're the fools. And we project onto, not the Son Christ here, but the fool Christ, the harlequin Christ, our foolishness.
Okay.
And we punish God for our stupidity. And we hurt ourselves, but we're also hurting God. God gives us a perfect world and we destroy it. Who's stupid there? Is it the perfect world? No, it's just our stupidity.
Mm.
Gee whiz, that could even civilization now.
I'm going to ask, just put this out. Most of these images have three separate pictures. Now, the only other...
That's right. I have three.
Three separate pictures. Now, Father, Son, Holy Ghost. Like three levels.
Right. There's two things going on, all of these pictures. Between them and in them, they are dyadic. They have two dimensions, or they're triadic.
Mm-hmm.
And the same way, also, the cards can be seen in dyadic and triadic formations. And I think that if you look at the when you look at them, you can see how several of them pair up easily. You know, because of symbolic elements, but in other cases, I think the sephira symbolism will give you a hint of how to read them triadically and dyadically.
Mm-hmm.
And you could probably also read them in a fivefold way too. You know, it's more complex with the star image type thing, but. I don't know if how much that'll hold out. Do remember a thing question that I've got, which is, what is the significance of the four images entitled Shekinah?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the moon, justice, the star, and the world. And again, those come up next week and the week after. But they're all Shekinah. And why not the empress and the high priestess or temperance?
Mm.
Which are the classic ones that are that we usually see as relevant to the Shekinah. So so you have this fourfold: the moon, justice, star, and the world. A fourfold repetition of the Shekinah. Interesting question. I don't. As I said, it's just, and we can see if that plays out. Anywhere. So, we're over past our 9 o'clock time, so I want to thank everybody tonight. I hope you had a good time.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Paul.
I have. You've actually, I know I sound like I'm the know-it-all here, but you guys actually have taught me plenty with this exercise. And, only two more weeks to go, and we will have a pretty good idea of how to understand these cards, or at least something that will eventually become a pretty good idea.
Okay.
Take care, everybody.
Okay, good night.
Good night, everyone. Thank you so much.